We're going to talk a little girl group music, some of my favorite music from the late 50s and early 60s, with our friend Colin Fleming. First, a little bit from the Chantels. Oh, I love that song so much. Arlene Smith, who was... Colin, how old was she? About 15 when she recorded that song?
Yes, and given the subject matter of the song, although I guess it's kind of right, relevant, on cue, on the nose, song about virginity, and that's what people are thinking about at that age, so it makes it apropos. But yes, quite young, and as we can hear in the vocal there, quite operatic as well, really. You don't hear many pop singers singing like that then, now, anytime in between with those extended melismas. And it's really like she's launching herself vocally off a cliff into the unknown. So we have a kind of text painting there, too. Same thing that Handel would do, but we have that going on in this girl group number from the end of the 50s.
And Chantels didn't have the success on the charts that a couple other groups that we'll talk about did, like the Shirelles and the Marvelettes. But Arlene Smith was so talented, she wrote a lot of their songs herself, even as a teenager.
She did, and sometimes she'd be uncredited. But what they really did, the Chantels, were they didn't have quite the success that we're going to see with some of these other acts, like you said. But this was a big deal, that you have this all-girl group and all African-Americans, and they're crossing over in big ways that just was not done. You have to remember that at this time, you still had things like the race charts, really. You had rhythm and blues charts, you had that sort of thing, and you'd have interesting nuances where the Everly Brothers would show up on a rhythm and blues chart and things of that nature. But this was really a big forerunning type of massive deal. You didn't get this, and you had this group, too, that appealed to both boys and girls. So a lot of amalgamation was happening with the Chantels, and it's such a distinctive sound where I really don't know another pop record that sounds like something like Maybe. Really, in all of these years since, there's nothing quite like those melismas. Nobody sings like that. She's singing really, too. It's quite strange. She's singing with rubato. So the music underneath her is in a certain 4-4 meter, but she's not really singing in 4-4. She's doing this different vocal superimposition on top of the basso continuo. It's highly unusual. You wouldn't ever really hear anyone sing like that.
Love the Chantels, but let's talk about a group that had a much greater level of success, credited as being the first all-girl group to reach number one, and we're talking about the girls from Passaic, New Jersey, the Shirelles.
The Shirelles, yes, and beloved by especially the Beatles, and I think probably that they are the Beatles of the girl groups. And people have to realize, too, in case you're not familiar with this kind of music or you only know it from the oldie station in the car, we're not being pejorative by using the term girl group. It's almost like, I really like Josh Gibson. He was a star of the Negro Leagues. That's what these units were, in fact, called at the time. And the Shirelles were perhaps the most skilled, and they had a career that sustained well, too. And the Beatles fell in love with them to the degree that not only did they cover songs like Baby It's You and the BBC and on their first album, Please Please Me, but they covered Boys, which you have to think about this. This is a time where machismo reigned supreme, and a group like the Beatles wanted to be tough guys. They weren't this lovable mop-top outfit that the press fashioned them as. And so to sing the song Boys, you have to sing this song about being in love with males and having crushes on males and wanting to hook up with males. And the Beatles, four guys from this tough northern English town, what are you going to do? Change it to girls? I've been told when a girl takes a trip around the world, like, you can't do that. So you have to either just throw this out or you have to embrace it and go for it. And other British bands, what you'll notice if you're into that kind of music, is they all cover a lot of the same material. Jerry and the Pacemakers cover the same tunes that the Stones would cover, that the Beatles would cover, that the Yardbirds would cover, that sort of thing. Nobody else is covering Boys. That's how much they were fans of the Shirelles, the Beatles, and I think you can hear a lot of the way the Beatles built up their vocal sound, their harmonies, where you often cannot tell who is singing the lead vocal and who is singing the harmony almost. The harmony becomes this connective tissue for the lead vocal. The Beatles really got that, I think, from the Shirelles more than anyone.
Shirelles had a top 40 hit with Tonight's the Night, but the song that really propelled them to new levels of success, a Carole King, Jerry Goffin song, and well, following that theme we talked about with maybe virginity and the potential loss thereof, with a song that was controversial at the time, Will You Love Me Tomorrow?
That song and Tonight the Night, they were really the same subject matter, correct?
I mean, right.
Not really going that far from that notion of, not to make a body pun, but piercing the veil, going
right
beyond the known in a very gynecological sense, but also in this progression into adulthood sense. These are very mature themes, and they weren't handled cheaply. They weren't handled as kitsch. They weren't handled for shock value. They were these tone poems that were very bouncy, nonetheless, that were highly rhythmic, highly melodic, and right back to the Chantels. And maybe the Chantels gave the Shirelles the courage to come screaming in with this type of thing. To paraphrase Lennon when he was working on Don't Let Me Down, he said, give me the courage to come screaming into this. Maybe that's what happened here, because, again, they're interpreting material. They're writing some of it, but oftentimes it's coming from professional songwriters. And professional songwriters, we have to keep in mind, too, we're also writing very body material for people like Elvis, so he can pump his hips to that on TV and whatnot, and very salacious music with Elvis. But here it's salacity with a dollop of a different kind of class, I would say.
And then let's talk about a girl group from Michigan that became, next to the Miracles, the first real big success for Berry Gordy and Motown Records, the Marvelettes.
Marvelettes, where everybody would know, of course, Please, Mr. Postman. And they had this way that they would use their vocal lineup where, again, it would all be unison singing. And from that unison, a single voice would emerge. And it's a very dramatic approach to music, because everything's going along and it seems fairly static. Like, here we go, we're a gang. And it was a kind of gang. These were tough units. These weren't just like simpletons or rubes put together, like, okay, answer this ad and you come from here. These were tight-knit people. This was a kind of sisterhood. And that lead vocal would emerge eventually, often not at the beginning of the song. And when it broke through, it was sun through clouds. It was like, okay, wow. Is it, again, another Beatles reference. It was like in the middle eight of This Boy, where they're singing the harmony vocal. And then Lennon just breaks forward. He comes out from ahead of Harrison and McCartney, and he takes over. And that is a classic Marvelettes trick. And if you go back to the 1962, the first BBC session the Beatles did, they cover Please, Mr. Postman. And they are so euphoric to be tackling this material. And it's so funky. It's almost this proto-hip-hop type of beat to the song. And that suited them well. And again, it was just so far ahead of its time.
And so many other great girl groups. We've talked about the Ronettes, Be My Baby, one of the epic songs in the history of rock and roll, the influence of Phil Spector as well. I just love that sound.
I think it's a little bit different with the Ronettes, because so much of that sound is the Phil Spector principle almost. It's almost like in Mancunian music, you'd have that Martin Hannett influence where he is an instrument unto himself, and he's almost co-opting sounds by groups like Joy Division, to the point where they're complaining later after the record comes out and everyone hails it, saying, that's not my guitar. That's what's happening here. So a lot of that, I think, was Phil Spector, the wall of sound. And not that that's a lesser form of song art, but I feel like there's something more organic, more in the room with you, with like the Shirelles. For instance, they have that tacky toy piano that they use on some of the songs. You hear it on Baby It's You. And it's just like something your kid sister might have that she got for Christmas that she doesn't touch anymore. And they're like, okay, we'll have this as part of the proceedings. And that's that real living room feel. It's very warm and very enveloping. And I think, especially with them, you really get that there.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. And let's shift gears a little bit and listen a little more. Hope you're stretched out and don't pull anything here.
Come on, baby. Let's do that twist. Come on, baby. Let's do that twist.
Not gonna lie, Colin, I was pretty good at doing the twist when I was about 4 and 5 years old. I had it down.
Well, it's a dance that if you are like me and you can only do as your go-to dance, a series of violent pelvic thrusts to dance for you. You just make little fists off to the side instead of pelvically thrusting latitudinally, just make it go a little bit to the sides as you're doing your thing.
And seriously, and one of my earliest memories is of being, four, maybe 5 years old, and that song coming on and showing off my awesome moves that, frankly, peaked at that age.
I like that he comes back the next year, and he goes all intertextual, like he's a Russian futurist in the early 1920s. He's like, let's twist again. Like we did last summer. It's like, whoa, postmodernism from Chubby Checker. You're referencing yourself. That's pretty deep.
But well, and there have been dance crazes before and since then, but I don't know if any caught on and spawned the number of songs like The Twist did. And it's the only song still in the history of the Billboard charts to hit number one, the same version, to hit number one in separate years. He went to the top of the charts in 60, and then in 1962, back at number one again.
It's ironic because it would seem to be this hugely limited form of, not even really a form, a subform, a niche form, whatever you want to call it, where if you listen to the original version of it, and we're talking about this now because Chubby Checker did his thing in 1960, so we're 60 years ago. But the year before, Hank Ballard did a version of it. And it's very different. It's, I would call it down-home rhythm and blues. Like, it's classic. It's not like swamp blues, Slim Harpo stuff, but it's pretty like you have your hand in the dirt with that song. It's not, it's a very black sound, I would say, whereas Chubby Checker was more this kind of blank slate. It wasn't a rhythm and blues record. It wasn't soul. It wasn't proto-soul. But it's just so limited quarterly. Like, there's not that much going on with it. You wouldn't think that much could come from it. But realize, too, that something like Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers, that's based out of The Twist. Now, because there were people, it's like when Coltrane did his Giant Steps song, where he's taking these chord progressions and he's writing into these substitution chords into it. That's what people essentially did. They had substitution changes with The Twist. So you get the Isley Brothers doing Twist and Shout, and then the Beatles rock that up. So you're still in the Twist mode, technically, because these bands, they gig. And when you gig, you were a dance band. You had to find a way to work this into your set. And all great bands have always gigged. I mean, Count Basie and Duke Ellington in their prime, those bands. Late 30s, early 40s, they're going and they're playing dances. It was no different for the likes of these given units, like the Beatles. And they'd go and there'd be drunken German sailors. That's what was happening around the time, 1961, 1962. And they had to satiate these people with their twist songs. So I think, really, that's also how they got themselves to the point of doing this ultimate rock and roll vocal with Twist and Shout.
And songs like, you know, Joey D and the Starlighters, the Peppermint Twist, and one of the great twist songs of all time, Sam Cooke's Twist in the Night Away.
The twist was massive for Sam Cooke. And what he did was he was shoehorned into making a twist album. And Sam Cooke had these concept albums, which you wouldn't expect really Sam Cooke would necessarily have. But his company was like, okay, go and do this. Yeah, you have to do an album. Give us a half hour of twist songs. And he wrote so many of the songs on this album. Now, Sam Cooke is one of the best songwriters of the decade of the 1960s, and very few people think of Sam Cooke that way. But if you wanted to go to an album where he is writing the bulk of the content, it would be this album, where, of course, you have the title track. And the title track is a long way away from the Chubby Checker number with Sam Cooke's Twist in the Night Away. It is so funky, danceable, and clever. And the wordplay, it's almost like he's Edward Lear. there's so much going on in it. And he gets all worked up. He has this one. It sounds like it's going to be ridiculous, called Twisting in the Kitchen with Dinah. It's a novelty number, right? Like Elvis singing about harvesting shrimp. But it's not that at all. It is, again, this very funky song where Sam Cooke does this thing that very few singers have ever done. And he sort of discovers it here. He gets so into the rhythm of his lead vocal that he ends up singing his own backing vocal as well. Who does that? So he's duetting with himself, but it's not an overdub type of deal. He's just that caught up in the rhythm. And that, again, that stasis that we're going to get with the twist, that kind of two-beat stasis, frees Sam Cooke up to do all of these vocalizations, these improvisations that he hadn't been doing before. And that's going to pay off big time later when we hear him on live records, that sort of thing. And it changed how he made music. And he does a version of the Hank Ballard song, The Twist, and he takes it at a slower tempo. And he says, as he's singing it, let's try this out. Like, any idiot can do this dance. But what he's doing is he's building rhythm in his voice. And he starts saying the word around and around and around and around over and over again. It becomes this big circle of rhythm. And he builds this entire groove off of that one word, just around and around. And you'll hear him later at Live at the Harlem Square Club. And he starts doing it. And again, it's come from this idea of the twist, this seemingly innocuous, mostly meaningless, kind of annoying dance craze.
And speaking of Sam Cooke, you're working on a book that should be out soon on Sam Cooke's Live at the Harlem Square Club 1963.
Yes, I have to put some more work into that, but it's 33 and a third book, and music fans will know that series. It's from Bloomsbury, and it's each book is on a single album. And I am arguing essentially that this concert that Sam Cooke gave on January 12, 1963 at this black club in the black section of Miami is crucial not only as a work of music unto itself, but in getting him to become the writer. You hear him figuring it out on stage. You hear him interpolating his early gospel music. You hear him interpolating this twist music we're talking about. And you hear him working this black audience, and he would work a black audience much different than he would a white audience, and it's all black here. You hear him becoming the artist who's going to be capable of writing what I will call the most significant song of the 20th century. Of course, his famous single that would come out a little bit after that, Change is Going to Come. I think A Change is Going to Come and Strange Fruit are the two most important songs of the last 100 years, and I would give the nod even to A Change is Going to Come because there's just nothing like it in the history of recorded sound. But you hear him piecing it together on this stage and getting there, and a big part of that is going to be the lift he gets from this absurd dance craze and how he rejiggered that into his compositional process.
Tying it all together like nobody else in the business does. It's Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown. Good to talk to you. Missed not having you on here, not having a show the last couple of weeks. So good to have you back on with us, and we'll check in again next Tuesday afternoon.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming. Check out his work at colinflemminglit.com.